this is one of the most enjoyable tasks I have as director. That is introducing our own faculty who are coming to give these talks for these Wednesday brown bags. It's these sorts of occasions that I hope give us all an opportunity to learn about the interesting things happening on our campus already, and I hope to make new connections within our CREASE community. And it is an enormous pleasure to introduce our speaker today. Christy Fayervari is the senior elected member of the CREASE Executive Committee, I can say. And this, you didn't even know that, did you? She is the senior member. Yeah, how about that? She's glad she came today. And this is only in her third year in Ann Arbor. This is amazing. She's assistant professor of anthropology. She has research trajectories that emphasize Hungary, state socialism, the theories and practice of consumer goods, consumption, all of these things we'll be hearing about today. She was educated at Brown, at St. John's, and then at Chicago, and she taught at UNC Chapel Hill and at Duke before coming to Michigan in 2007. Now that she's here, our students have been the beneficiaries of her classes, such as East Central European Film, Anthropology of the Body, Globalizing Consumer Cultures, and my personal favorite course title, with an eye to student recruitment, Sex and Money. Wonder how that
wasn't me.
That wasn't you. She's going to disavow that one. And I'll close with just a shameless Reese-focused plug. That is to note and to announce, really, that Christy has agreed now to completely redesign and to teach a new anthropology and Reese survey of East and Central European cultures, which we will be offering and listing next semester. This is in winter 2010 as Reese 397. It also has an anthro number, 317, I think. Eastern Europe in Transformation. And so for all the students in the room, I want to make sure you're aware of that as you're approaching registration time for next semester. Her talk today presents a slice of her scholarship and research interests, and it's called, as you can see on the screen, Socialist Generic Branding and State Legitimacy in Socialist Hungary.
Kristen. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I see a lot of familiar faces, and also there are a lot of Hungarians in the room, so they can take me to task for what I get wrong in the Hungarian ads that I'm going to show. The Sex and Money class was not my idea. I just want to set the record straight on that one. This is coming out of some other work that I've done, and it's actually through the web that I've been able to sort of do a lot more research and get access to a lot more materials than I would have even 5-10 years ago. So it was kind of by poking around a little bit that I started being able to sort of access stuff from the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, not just photographs of things, but actual television advertising footage. So it's still very much a project in its early stages, and I hope to be able to do more research on it. A reason often given for state socialism's collapse is that it failed to produce quantity and quality of consumer goods desired by its citizens. And yet, 20 years later, the Hungarian Tisza shoe brand, with only slightly modified versions of some of its most popular styles from the late 70s, is the latest fad not only in the streets of Budapest, but among a hip crowd throughout Europe. Much has been written about this paradox of how a political system associated with shoddy, uniform, and badly designed products has managed to emerge as a potent counterculture symbol through replicas of these very same products. As the cultural historian Ina Merkel has remarked, the GDR, which became defunct as a society of shortage, celebrates its resurrection as, of all things, a brand. But in my talk today, I want to investigate this supposed paradox by thinking more about the particularities of state socialist consumer culture, one where producers and retailers were not competing for consumers. In the centrally planned socialist economy, the state was the determining producer, the determining presence in economic life as the primary producer, distributor, retailer, and marketer of all consumer goods and housing. So unlike modern capitalist states in the post-war era, which increasingly served as the mediator between commercial interests and the rights of citizens as consumers, the socialist state designated itself solely responsible for both determining and fulfilling material needs. In other words, central planners, guided by priorities laid down by the party, decided on what constituted a legitimate need and then dictated the production and distribution of whatever it was that fulfilled that need. Even though goods were, of course, made in particular factories, workshops, and farms, the fact that they all operated under the auspices of the state meant that the state as a unitary system became seen as the ultimate source of these mass-produced goods and built environments. And I hope this point becomes clearer as I go along. As I've argued elsewhere, the state's legitimacy over the years was eroded by the ways it was aligned with goods produced for its citizens. Indeed, citizens experienced reinforcing parallels between their encounters with the bureaucratic state and their everyday struggles with the material worlds the state produced. It is within this context that I'm interested in how brands and branding practices worked, and not in ways one would expect. In particular, I've been curious about two things. First, despite its monopoly over the market, why did the social state go to the trouble of branding things in the first place? And second, with the increasing amount of goods available, especially branded goods, why didn't Hungarians' attitudes about goods produced by the states improve? In most analyses, Western goods are assumed to be the standard against which socialist goods were unfavorably compared. But I will argue here that branding practices creating differentiation within socialist production in an attempt to create distinctive goods were just as damaging to evaluations of state production and consequently perceptions of how the state valued its citizenry. Okay. So I'm making this kind of parallel between alienation and appropriation, generic and a branded, as a heuristic. I know it has a lot of problems, but I think it's a nice way to think through what I'm going to be talking about. Most anthropological approaches to consumption, whether acknowledged or not, begin from the Marxist position that commodities exist in a state of alienation from the consumer. When goods of production are commodified, the producer has to buy back the products of his or her own labor. But another approach put forward by Daniel Miller draws on Georg Simmel to argue that the alienation of commodities arises from the conditions of modernity and the qualities of the commodities produced en masse and their sheer quantity. According to Simmel, consumers confront the vast amount of mass-produced standardized goods available in modern industrialized societies as external to themselves as particularly alienated. Even after purchase, such goods require social labor to transform them from their commodity state into inalienable possessions. In other words, taking an object that was commensurable with a vast array of other goods, other objects, and making it unique, singularizing it within a particular context, and integrating it into a person or group's social life. While most anthropologists would insist that such appropriation cannot happen until after purchase, James Carrier has pointed to marketing devices such as catalog narratives as greatly assisting in the work of appropriation before purchase, something marketing theorists have assumed all along. This implies that there are vast differences in the degree to which consumers confront the commodity as alienated in the first place. Advertising, the work of product designers, store layouts and displays, the behaviors of sales clerks, real estate agents, and so forth, all sell through constructing and then naturalizing a unique fit between the product and the consumer. What were once mass-produced commodities become one of a kind, with a unique history, origin, and even producer, tailored to the individual needs and desires of the buyer, thus reducing a sense of impersonal, alienated object upon receipt. Branding, of course, is one way in which products are imbued with social and cultural meanings and are anchored to existing values, places, and times independent of particular consumers. As Rob Moore has defined it, a branded product communicates information about the source, producer, and type of thing. So branding can provide rich sociocultural and ideological captioning for the object. Moreover, consumer research in capitalist contexts has demonstrated the capacity of a product through its design and branding to convey affective messages such as caring from the source company to the consumer and so elicit trust and thus garner brand loyalty. For example, designers of car interiors work to surprise customers with little features like cup holders in a convenient spot, so unexpected features, that makes the car itself and by extension the car makers communicate, right, its attention to buyers' comforts, even anticipating conveniences he or she hadn't even considered. So in that sense, the product itself, by anticipating things you didn't even know you needed, is conveying an affective message, right? Okay, so we can see this play between alienated mass-produced goods on the one hand and goods that are imbued with rich cultural meanings on the other, and the opposition between generic products and branded goods. In capitalist markets, the generic brand or brandless brand consists of mass-produced basic goods with minimal packaging and label design like these, and no advertising. Generic products only provide basic information about the product as use value, and nothing on the product's source or origins, no contextualization outside of their existence on the store shelf. And I have to point out here that sort of all of this kind of depends on trust and state regulations to ensure sort of the basic safety of products and guarantees to sort of basic standards of effectiveness. Nonetheless, in capitalist contexts, this very setting on the store shelf provides generic brands with meaning and value. They exist in a cultural context where consumers are aware that the price of branded goods, and sometimes a substantial part of that price, pays for the marketing of that good rather than the quality of the product. The thrifty shopper can then reason that the price he or she is paying is for the quality of the product itself and that they're not being manipulated by advertisers. Even so, completely no-name brands have largely disappeared. Store brands or own brands that at least identify the parent company as a locatable source for the product are far more successful. They say that that no brand sorts of things do better in bad economies. So maybe we'll see a return of the complete generic brand. In state socialist contexts, this relationship was reversed. In fact, most goods and even retail spaces were what we might call generic. And that's my basic argument in this talk. The bulk of state socialist material production, from goods to living environments, adhered to modernist design principles of abstraction, ahistoricism, and timelessness, especially after the 50s. Architects and product designers strove to eliminate references to place or time in their products. As I will try to show in what follows, these products did communicate information about their source, as they were iconic of an institutional and bureaucratic state. In contrast, branded goods, singularized by proper names, logos, and places, and cultural associations obtain their meanings in part via their difference from the mass-produced standardized goods and retail environments of the state. So it's a reversal where the backdrop is the generic brandless, and what gets differentiated are the branded goods. For the socialist state, consumer goods and consumption in general posed numerous problems, both ideological and economic. Socialist consumption had to be qualitatively different from capitalist consumption, which was based on exploitative modes of production, unequal distribution, and competition. Figuring out the appropriate socialist mode of consumption was a recurring topic for heated debate. Advertising, window displays, exhibitions, magazine spreads, and newspaper editorials had the paradoxical task of displaying socialist consumer products in the best possible light, but at the same time discouraging conspicuous consumption, the undue influence of fashion, and unnecessary waste. Here's some examples of how ads were supposed to instill pride in socialist production, but also to promote their correct and tasteful use in order to modernize and civilize backward segments of the population. Advertisements educated consumers about newly available products and the use of new technologies, and in the process encouraged them to modernize their habits, raise their standards of hygiene, and become more discriminating in their tastes. So in this one, the disciplining measures of having a clock in every room, and that one, the sort of modern color of plastics, modern plastics, you can even jump on them, they won't break. A major principle behind the ways consumer goods were promoted and displayed was a desire for transparency and truth in comparison to capitalist deceit and misrepresentation. This echoed modernist avant-garde ideologies from the 20s in everything from buildings to letter fonts. In contrast to so-called bourgeois preoccupation with facade and artifice, socialist forms were to be legible to the public through their unadorned simplicity. So instead of having shops with the surname of the original owner or another proper name, they were called by simple descriptives in standardized block letters. So in every town in Hungary, shoe stores were designated with block type reading shoe store, that's the, or meat store, and stationery shops by the acronym for estate paper and writing implements, or APIS. And that I got from Ava. These names reinforce the sense of institutional standardization through their resolute literalness, branding the socialist state, you might say, with this austere but unified design. Window displays done by the same window designers working out of a central office were often uniform, highlighting the fact that the few shoes displayed in each window were identical across the shops. And finally, state socialist goods were rarely framed by the elaborate packaging that became the norm in the commercial West that framed commodities as gifts. These practices emphasized rather than mitigated the generic qualities of consumer goods and their abstract origins, reinforcing the impersonal state as the source for goods that people had to use on an everyday basis. Such ordinary goods were distinguished by modern, simple, no-frills designs and little product differentiation. These qualities stemmed in part from economic considerations as they were cheaper to produce, but they also solved an ideological problem associated with too many consumer goods, namely that people would use them as a means of distinction. After all, while it was important that the population adopt a modern standard of living, it was preferable for people to have the same things and live in similar homes. But for many, these generic and bulk goods and environments were experienced as things that the state threw out at them, and that's a common expression throughout the Eastern Bloc. The dregs are afterthoughts of production. They index the state's lack of consideration for citizens as individuals and families with different and particular needs and desires. Okay, building socialism in the 50s. Despite the genericism of much of state socialist production, branded goods were produced over the years. As production of consumer goods increased, so did the number and variety of branded products. The principles behind branding also shifted over time. The first decade of state socialism in Hungary, the 50s, the Stalinist 50s, was devoted to the cause of building socialism both literally and figuratively. Stalin had rejected modernist ideologies of transparent meaning through material forms, condemning abstract art and cube-like architecture as elitist and incomprehensible to the common man, very much like Bourdieu. Modernism was in the early 50s, Hungarian Stalinists followed his lead. Modernism was modified by the aesthetic principles and ideologies of socialist realism, which stipulated that everything that was being built or created was supposed to contribute to the emergence of a new socialist modernity. Instead of transparent meanings, new buildings, environments, and products were to have single meanings, meanings that were reinforced with educational banners and explanatory captions. From building new towns to product packaging, everything in the material world was understood in having a role in educating and transforming the populist into a socialist society. Cigarette boxes, for example, were a perfect vehicle for promoting state-led projects, such as the brand Plan. So that's the plan, which came in 3-year plan and 5-year plan varieties. This type of branding was also used to signify the break from capitalist labor relations and to underscore that state socialist products were made primarily for those who produced them, thus the prominence of the brand Munkash, or worker, which was quite popular until production ended in the late 80s. Given the limited range of consumer goods produced in the 50s, branding was also used to differentiate special occasion products from everyday non-branded ones, things like champagne, chocolates, scented soaps, and other luxuries that in principle would be available to all socialist workers at particular times of the year. So, for example, oranges were produced around Christmas and Easter. and I couldn't find actually a Hungarian socialist ad for Turley because this was an old pre-socialist champagne concern that got taken over by the socialists but is now still a big brand. So all the images, the Turley. And that's the Soviet champagne, also made for the same purpose. Large, durable, prestige items like cars, refrigerators, and televisions were also branded to index their status, while small and pleasurable consumables like candies were given proper names. Many goods imported from other Comic-Con countries had a sticker which identified the nation that had produced them as a specialty, such as toys from East Germany or crystal from Czechoslovakia. Finally, some particularly modern products were branded in the attempt to create socialism's answer to what Doug Holt has called iconic brands in the West, like Coca-Cola, goods which were already known in the pre-socialist era or were circulated via the black market. So an example was the orange-flavored Bambi soda, first produced in 1954. And I can't figure out whether Bambi comes from when the Disney film was released, but it'd be interesting to know that. The way such carbonated beverages were marketed, moreover, reveals the state wanted to produce a beverage for adult sociality, which would replace alcohol, a tactic that continued through the 80s. So I'm going to show you now an ad for a different kind of soda called Marka. And Marka in Hungarian means brand. So it's basically brand soda. And it's from the late 70s. I can't quite date it, so it's a little bit out of sequence, but see the Pertu? gambling. The point of showing that, I don't know if you noticed, but they drink Pertus. So they're doing all these things that would normally be done with alcoholic beverages, and you couldn't imagine these rituals with, but they keep saying, drink up, you know, it's so, drink up, like a drinking song, with brand soda. Okay, I was talking about this moment when the battlefield of the Cold War shifted from sort of military battle to sort of one and on the terrain of consumer culture. And this Khrushchev's famous declaration that the Russians are going to catch up by 1985, not 1984, which would have been poignant. Anyway, in so doing, he tied the legitimacy of the communist regime not simply to its ability to provide housing, education, employment, and medical care, but its ability to produce a higher quality and greater variety of consumer goods. The socialist state reinforced its alignment with and responsibility for the qualities of these mass-produced material goods in a number of ways. First, post-Stalin-era policies boosting the production of consumer goods were presented as signs of state munificence in caring for its subjects. Second, though citizens were not allowed to criticize a number of taboo topics like the Soviet Union, the Communist Party, or the principle of central planning, they were actually encouraged to protest certain things like manufacturing flaws through institutionalized venues for lodging complaints. And any of you who saw the film Goodbye Lenin knows that the mom, who is this communist functionary, spends her days writing letters of complaints about boxy shirts and jumbo underwear. Finally, by making a modernist design the dominant aesthetic for state production, particularly of housing and furnishing, the socialist state, both a political entity and its legitimating ideology, created a recognizable style, something we can think of in terms of brand identity. Through these practices, the state effectively invited the population to evaluate it in terms of its consumable production. The 60s in Hungary were a time of profound change in the realm of consumer and popular culture. Hungarians followed the cultural transformations going on in the West and adopted many forms locally. Along with espresso bars and topless dance clubs, long-haired youth and teenage girls in model brand miniskirts, Elvis Presley on smuggled vinyl albums and Riga motor scooters, a vibrant popular consumer culture was developing in Hungary, especially in the larger cities. The heavy-handed ideological motifs of the 50s gave way to lighter and more playful ones. For example, cigarette brands broadened to include not only Balatoni, named for Hungary's largest lake and leisure resort area, but to reintroduce favorites from the pre-socialist era, such as the high-register Symphonia. Socialist states also began importing more consumer goods from the West in order to improve their ratings, going into substantial debt to do so. Nice coffees, chocolates, toiletries, and some electronic goods were marked as special by their gift packaging or by the retail location in which they were sold. For example, available for purchase only in specialty shops and often only for Western hard currency. In Hungary, luxury versions of standard issue clothes, soaps, and other goods could be had for a steep price. The state also introduced new consumer venues such as a new department store chain called Skala, though in the modernist design that cemented its association with state production and distribution. That's the one in Dunajváros, the city that I did my fieldwork in, on the right. Here's another one, the Blue Danube department store, again in this modernist. And again, the way the advertising on the left sort of conflates modernist design of products with the modernist design of the architecture. And part of my argument is just this particular generic modernist design is what ends up becoming associated in particular with state production. Taking a cue from new consumer-friendly venues being developed in the West, the state developed a line of self-service convenience stores playfully called ABC for the range of goods it had under one roof. State manufacturing entities also began to introduce more product differentiation within the line of state socialist products. With the limited decentralization of the economy in the 1960s and 70s came an erosion of an ideological principle upheld during the Stalinist times. According to Marxist-Leninist purists, all of socialist production should be attributed to an abstracted and generalized workforce. Obscuring the specific origins of goods therefore emphasized the abstract labor power of the collective. There had always been exceptions to this general rule, particularly for goods like regional wines or as mineral waters, as Paul Manning discusses in a paper, for which the source constituted a critical part of the product, or pre-war era luxury goods developed for the Soviet market, like the Turley champagne I showed you earlier. But in general, goods of socialist production were marked with the name of the national manufacturing organization, such as the Hungarian clock manufacturers, not the particular factory or the town that made it. Many of the new brands were given place names, names that fixed them somewhere in socialist geographic space, whether to draw on cultural associations with that place, like cigarettes from Balaton, or for place of manufacture, such as the Riga motor scooter, named for the capital of Latvia. The allure of the Riga motor scooter was in no small part that it was made in one of the Baltic countries, known to be far more westernized than the rest of the Soviet Union. It didn't hurt that the Riga motorcycle factory essentially copied popular French and Italian models. Some of these branded goods traded on the widely known, even if not publicized, reputation of factories that had been in existence in pre-socialist times. The Turley brand of champagne is one example, and the Tisza shoe brand is another. Tisza is not only the name of Hungary's second largest river, but the name of a shoe factory that had been a subsidiary of the Bata Shoe Corporation in the 40s before it was nationalized and folded into the state shoe manufacturing entity. In the early 70s, Tisza applied for and regained its brand status and logo and garnered international recognition for its shoes. It even began producing a line of soccer cleats for Adidas. The public met all of these innovations with widespread approval, but positive effects on political subjectivity were often tempered by other factors. Brands meant to replace iconic brands in the West suffered from their derivative status. So socialist brand name sodas like Bambi, while appreciated, were nonetheless understood to be imitations of Coca-Cola, simulacra rather than the real thing. So it is no surprise that it's precisely these goods that come to be valued as authentic in the post-socialist period. Local brands, which indexed a specific origin within the country, like Tisza shoes and their distinguishing logo, shifted the source of the shoes from generic state production to that of a unique situated producer, the Tisza shoe factory. So even though Tisza was still a nationalized company, the state as production system was no longer recognized as the source for this quality product. So credit now goes to the individuated Tisza concern. These examples bring up another critical dimension to the cultural effects of branding in the socialist system, one related to the concern with the identities communicated by brands and taken up by users. This was the branding of goods for export, something Hungarians were sensitive to for a number of reasons. Hungary's international reputation was seen to ride in part on the quality of design, workmanship, and materials of these exports, and the way that they were received by both countries to the literal and figurative West and East. Like emissaries of Hungarian value, these goods circulating in the world were consequential for Hungary's worth and fame. Thus, while high-quality exports like Tungsram light bulbs, Icarus buses, and Tisza shoes made Hungarians proud, the overall decline in quality of Hungarian products under socialism was seen to be indexical of the decline of the nation's standards as a people. Particularly galling, then, was when beloved brands dating from the pre-socialist era were degraded after their factories were nationalized. And an example is furniture produced by the former Lingel company, which had once produced high-quality furniture and was now producing very low-quality and boxy socialist furniture. On the other hand, Hungarians were aware that the highest-quality goods were being exported to Western countries and were often not available for consumption in Hungary. Meanwhile, Hungarians were left with mediocre to inferior goods for their own use. And even though people were aware of the economic factors necessitating such command decisions, they laid the blame at the state's doorstep. The fact that the socialist state was identified with low quality and generic goods was not lost on state retail concerns, which by now had become more decentralized. Store branding was used in an effort to distance new products from associations with generic state production and to mark them as distinctive goods, tied with a source to a name and a location. But as the following ad for Skala department store shows, this was a losing game. Okay, this is very quick. All right. In this ad, we can see how Scala tries to distance itself from all that other state production and the disappointments, aggravations, and anger that everyday engagement with such products elicited. Furthermore, the ad takes for granted that this experience with state socialist goods is widely shared and tries to make a break for Scala products from these assumptions, implying, we won't treat you like this, the hapless citizen consumer. But the unintended effect of this ad, as with other branded products, was to reinforce the status of unbranded goods with their modernist erasure of production processes as the generic deleterious of an impersonal and negligent state, the true brand of socialism. Okay, so in conclusion, mass-produced socialist generics shared many of the same qualities of generic mass-produced products in capitalist context, namely an impoverished meaning system, the absence of indices to the location or identity of a source. Much of the official consumer culture of the socialist state thus worked to maintain the alienated form of the commodities it sold or allocated. The aesthetic unity of this generic look reinforced the notion that the state was a unitary entity, one that did not care much about its citizens as consumers. In contrast, newly branded goods, which were supposed to bolster the legitimacy of the state, may have improved people's attitudes towards local Hungarian or Latvian production, but ironically, these goods were not attributed to the larger political entity of the Soviet-aligned socialist state. Okay, so in the post-socialist era, it has not been the generic goods of state socialism that resurface as objects of affection, like unbranded soap, but precisely those goods that had become branded in opposition to socialist generic, like the Tisa sports shoe, tongue twister. Thus, the paradox I began with now seems less paradoxical. The Tisa brand may still draw some ironic value from its association with the now defunct adversary of capitalist conformity, though it is just as likely that it has become cool again because it revisits the currently trendy 70s and an alternate 70s at that. Also, to think about the age of the people that are really into this, they were, you know, at most 10 when socialism ended. But if I'm right, then its current cachet as a counterculture symbol, at least for young Hungarians, comes instead from the fact that it was a successful product of Hungarian modernity, one positioned among the failed products of a socialist one. Even during socialism, this brand was marked as the counter-hegemonic exception. So I want to show you this last clip for this. This is Tisa now, and this is Tisa in the 70s. Okay, that's sort of what I mean by successful Hungarian modernity, where the emphasis on movement, the skateboards, informality, lots of diversity in those shoes, right? And also this appeal to the world is going to be dancing and singing in our, so nothing about socialist world, nothing about the collective, but about circulating Hungarian goods out in the world that we can be proud of. Okay, that's it.